y tú vendrás marchando junto a mí, y así verás tu canto y tu bandera florecer, la luz de un rojo amanecer anuncia ya la vida que vendrá. De pie marchar, el pueblo va a triunfar, será mejor la vida que vendrá, a conquistar nuestra felicidad, y en un clamor mil voces de combate se alzarán, dirán, canción de libertad, con decisión la patria vencerá. Y ahora el pueblo que se alza en la lucha con voz de gigante gritando adelante, el pueblo unido jamás será vencido, el pueblo unido jamás será vencido. La patria está forjando la unidad, de norte a sur se movilizará, desde el salar ardiente y mineral al bosque austral, unidos en la lucha y el trabajo irán, la patria cubrirán, su paso ya anuncia el porvenir. De pie cantar, el pueblo va a triunfar, millones ya imponen la verdad, de acero son, ardiente batallón, sus manos van llevando la justicia y la razón, mujer, con fuego y con valor, ya estás aquí junto al trabajador. Y ahora el pueblo que se alza en la lucha con voz de gigante gritando adelante, el pueblo unido jamás será vencido, el pueblo unido jamás será vencido, el pueblo
Uhuru. You are listening to Solidarity Not Charity on Uhuru Radio, the online voice of the International African Revolution. We are here. My name is Jesse Neville, and I am a member of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. I'm here with fellow members Kelly Barron and Matthew Diaghi.
Good afternoon.
We thank the African People's Socialist Party for giving us this hour on Uhuru Radio. We are honored to be a part of the Uhuru Movement and working in the Solidarity Movement under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party. We opened with the song El Pueblo Unido by Inti Illimani, because today we're going to be talking about the Arizona law SB 1070 and situating that law in the context of the history of U.S. colonialism of Mexican territory. The law SB 1070, signed into law by Governor Jan Brewer on Friday, April 23rd, it is another example of the brutal repression of the indigenous working class by the imperialist system. The law is a vicious white nationalist legislation designed to attack Mexican workers, the very same indigenous people from whom Arizona and the rest of occupied Mexico was stolen by white colonizers over the past 500 years. The corporate media in the U.S. and around the world has framed the controversy surrounding the bill as being one of racial profiling. But that really takes us away from the real issues of as far as what this bill represents. The idea of the immigrant in this instant must even be challenged, considering that Arizona and California and Nevada and Wyoming and
New Mexico.
New Mexico. These were all Mexico before 1850. And Utah. And Colorado. And if you look at the history of Mexico, it's the same story. It's white colonizers invading and declaring war and taking the resources and the land and pushing out the people. In 1836, Texas, aided by the United States, declared its independence from Mexico and called itself the Lone Star Republic before it was brought into the Union as a state by Act of Congress in 1845. Suddenly, the imperialists became excited about the prospect of taking more Mexican land for themselves. So the next year, U.S. President James Polk sent troops into Mexico to pick a fight with the indigenous people in order to justify a full-scale military invasion. The imperial motivation was to establish a pretext for acquiring California. President Polk falsely claimed Mexico had invaded the United States and asked Congress for a declaration of war. At the time, the two major parties were the Whig Party and the Democratic Party. The Whig Party was supposed to have been the party that was opposed to slavery and war, but of course they, along with the Democrats, viewed California as commercially valuable and voted overwhelmingly with the opposing major party in favor of the war. So this was an early instance of both major political parties in the U.S. acquiescing to the interests of the white ruling class and uniting around the common cause of imperial expansion, a dynamic which we see repeated in the current U.S. occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan. So with that history, that sort of broad sketch of colonial history in Mexico as our starting point, we want to get into a discussion about the realities faced by indigenous people trying to reclaim their stolen land and resources, the devastations of poverty that are imposed, the U.S.-sponsored drug economy, the vicious violence that is sponsored by the state and waged against the indigenous population, and finally, what we as people in the solidarity movement, North American and European people, what we can do to stand in solidarity with the revolutionary struggles of Mexican, indigenous, African, and other oppressed peoples around the world.
Uhuru.
So, I guess as far as talking about resources and stolen resources, one thing I think is notable is that Mexico is a major oil producer and exporter. Mm-hmm. And I have a quote here from a Mexican country profile on BBC, which even in its tone, it still reflects the imperialist attitudes of the BBC, but still gives a little history. It says, Mexico is a major oil producer and exporter. Though production has fallen in the last few years, about one-third of government revenue still comes from the industry. Much of the crude is bought by the U.S., but prosperity remains a dream for most Mexicans. Rural areas are often neglected, and huge shanty towns ring the cities. Many poor Mexicans try to cross the 3,000-kilometer border with the U.S. in search of a job, and more than a million are arrested every year. Hundreds die of heat exhaustion or thirst while making the attempt, and the exodus has led to some towns and villages in Mexico being virtually empty of able-bodied men. The violence waged against indigenous people that cross the border is something that we see all the time in the news, in the form of Border Patrol and Minutemen and these violence directly sponsored by the state, and also imperialist vigilantes, I guess you could call them.
Well, there's pride in the U.S. patrolling the border instead of focusing on why there are people trying to cross the border in the first place, and they don't give enough attention to the people who are actually trying to make this trip across, and don't question why they're coming from Mexico and what's going on there that would cause them to leave their home, you know, what kind of conditions are pushing them into the situation, life or death situation.
Well, you wouldn't expect a Minutemen to go around talking about U.S. government subsidized corn that we force Mexico to buy it over at overpriced expenses, and how our government subsidies of corn put millions of Mexican farmers out of jobs, and consequently you have them running to the borders, and not just from Mexico, all over Central America. Our economic foreign policies and free trade has wrecked the Latin American agricultural industry.
Yeah, and the news, instead of focusing on what kind of conditions illegal immigrants live with inside America, they mock these people and, you know, don't consider them human beings practically. And that's why they're sold and traded and put under harsh conditions by corporations that own all these businesses that are booming across the border.
There was something recently, a 14-year-old boy that was shot by border police Matthews.
Right. I believe it was about 2 weeks ago that there's actually a cell phone camera footage of the event where two young Mexican boys were engaged in a confrontation with a Border Patrol agent, and the claim is that the agent was being pelted with stones, which, while you cannot confirm it via the video, you know, regardless of what the case may be, shooting someone in response to getting stones thrown at you is a drastic over response. And it's what you see on the camera is that there is a Border Patrol agent running towards two young boys. He successfully apprehends one of them, grabbing him by the collar and dragging him to the ground. And then upon seeing the other boy run across to the Mexican side of the border, and there's no, it's more of an invisible line, it's along a riverbed of sorts, you see him run across to the Mexican side of the border. The officer, or the patrol agent, having seen the boy escape him, immediately, while still holding onto the collar of the other boy, draws his weapon and fires a series of very random shots at the boy, clearly not willing to let him go. The boy, I believe, took one bullet in the chest and was rushed to a hospital and was later pronounced dead. What's more interesting and more disturbing about the incident is that there was a number of people crossing the border who witnessed this from a bridge and obtained footage of it. These people, immediately after the event, were all hurried across the border and dispersed. There was one woman there who was actually phoning in the incident to the police, and she was being screamed at repeatedly she reported being yelled at repeatedly and accosted by a Border Patrol agent who obviously wanted to get rid of as many witnesses as possible. And you know, it's interesting because you wouldn't, if I was a Mexican crossing the border, going back and forth, whatever the case may be, I wouldn't get involved. I mean, I would like to think not. I mean, there's a lot of coming up and acting as a witness to a Border Patrol shooting a young boy. That's not going to get you back over the border anytime soon. So you have this courageous woman who was standing up to try and be a witness, and she was being bullied and intimidated by Border Patrol agents, but she stood her ground. And I believe this is becoming an international incident, as the Mexican ambassador to the U.S. has gotten involved directly. So it's... it can only get more interesting, or unfortunately, more interesting from here.
What we're seeing with all of this rising violence and what we're seeing is the intensification of the contradictions that imperialism mm-hmm. causes in the world, class contradictions, and the contradiction that occurs when Europeans come and North Americans come and take indigenous land and occupy it and exploit it and displace its indigenous population. So that's I think something that white people in particular need to be aware of is that we are the real immigrants here. We are the ones who came from somewhere else and mm-hmm. moved into this land and caused horrible destruction on the indigenous population. So the idea of a passport. I mean, the idea of a passport is an authentically European idea, designed to give Europeans privilege over the indigenous people.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a sign that there's some sort of power in a certain identity that separates one another from certain race and class, and all these events with the law, needing a law, and border patrol, and all these violent, extreme measures that the government has to take are examples of their struggle to control an artificial means of a destructive economy. It just gets worse and worse.
Yeah, the idea of a passport, like you said, is as far as we are concerned, our modern day passports stem from a European idea, which was to give the settlers privilege over any of the colonial over any of the indigenous people in the colonial territories. Someone can walk around with a British or Spanish or Dutch passport and say, "Well, I'm a Dutch citizen. You mess with me, you mess with all of the United Provinces, what have you." And we still have that kind of odd mentality today, where you see if, say, an American is apprehended doing something in another country, there's this almost irrational rush to defend them, regardless of what they may have been doing. It's odd. However, we as Americans, or Europeans, North Americans, we have passports that allow us to virtually fly through borders. You know, it's whereas most people are forced to wait in lines extensively, get checked. You know, where's your dad from? Where's your mother from? What do they do? And all these, for the most part, arbitrary questions. Where I've never been treated as a criminal at any border. Have I done things that could be considered a criminal? Probably, but there's no equality in that. I really believe that if you had North Americans or Europeans who were forced to wait at a border and endure the kind of humiliating treatment that many indigenous people are forced to face on a daily basis, just trying to get to and from, you know, work or whatever the case may be, I think there'd be a lot more compassion as far as the immigration question went. You know, I don't think it would be such a open and shut case for such people.
As we see indigenous people crossing these false borders that were imposed by imperialism and attempting to take back their own land and resources, it becomes clear that this whole debate is not an issue of immigration reform. The racist capitalist system cannot be reformed, nor should it be. It must be revolutionized by the self-determination of indigenous peoples themselves. And in all of these discussions that you see now in the mainstream media on Fox News and otherwise, you either see these frothing defenses of the bill, or you see people criticizing it from the point of view of, oh, we should be treating immigrants differently. Not questioning the basic idea of those people being immigrants when they're attempting to come back onto their own land. So we realize that the solution is not to call on Obama or anyone else to condemn this legislation. The solution to imperialism will not come from the imperialist system itself. Imperialism cannot fix itself. True social change will only be fulfilled through the revolutionary movements of oppressed peoples struggling for liberation from the false borders imposed by U.S. colonialism. And we see movements of resistance against U.S. colonialism, both inside the United States and around the world. Recently, Ron Gochez from the Unión del Barrio, which is a revolutionary Mexican organization in L.A., Ron Gochez and other members from the Unión del Barrio have they're teachers, and they organize for this revolutionary Mexican organization, and are very very brave, and this is a very powerful speech that Ron Gochez recently delivered at the La Raza rally in UCLA. So here we go.
By saying that the young man who spoke a little while ago was one of my students, and that made me so proud, because I know that our people have strong leaders for years and years to come. As a militante of Unión del Barrio, a revolutionary Mexican organization here, we understand what the camarada is saying. You're right, this is not just about Mexico. This is about a global struggle against imperialism and capitalism.
Yes.
But we know that all of that is happening in the context that where we now stand is stolen, occupied Mexico. Yeah. And the message that we bring is we want to bring a little bit more of a revolutionary context to this. Why is it that these people, these frail, racist white people, want to keep us out of this country? It's not because simply the color of our skin. It's not simply because they just want to exploit us. Let me tell you why. Because on this planet right now, of 6 billion people, at the forefront of the revolutionary movement is the raza. When you go to Venezuela, we have the long history and example of our comandante, Fidel Castro Ruz. We got Hugo Chavez, Evo Morales, we got Brazil, Ecuador, you name it. We have nine left of center governments in Latin America right now. And they know something that a one young Argentine called Che Guevara said. It was called the domino theory. And he knew that every single country would go revolutionary, one after the other, after the other, after the other. So what do they fear? They know that every single country, they know that we no longer will fall to these lies called borders. We know that a Salvadoran and a Guatemalan and a Nicaraguense and a Mexicano, there's no damn difference. We are all one people. So with that in mind, we see ourselves, all of us here, as the northern front of a Latin American revolutionary movement. More than 40 million of our people north of the Rio Grande. That means to them, there's 40 million potential revolutionaries north of the border, inside the belly of the beast. So when you think about why do they want to kick us, of all people, out, that's why. Because they know that we now know the truth. They know that now we are raza, we're professionals, we're educators, we are revolutionary students. What does that mean? We are not just a regular culture anymore. We're a culture of revolutionary spirit. And that's the fear. So with that being said, I want to leave you with this. As a revolutionary, and with revolutionary context, let's be clear about one thing. Our enemy is not the Minutemen. Quote me. Our enemy is not the Minutemen, because the Minutemen are not the ones who have killed over 4,600 people at those borders. That our enemy is the same enemy as Hugo Chavez, that Hugo Chavez has. Our enemy is the same enemy that keeps Africa poor. Our enemy is the same enemy that keeps Asia poor. Our enemy is capitalism and imperialism. Okay? That's it. If we are serious about making change, if you are serious about making change, let me tell you, the struggle will go on for many more years after we leave UCLA. Reading a book or writing a book or teaching a class, that is not part of the movement. What you do 24 hours a day as a professional revolutionary, that is what is going to lead our people and all people to liberation. Que viva la raza!
Ahuru. That was Ron Goches from the Unión del Barrio. They are a Mexican organization. The Uhuru movement has had a long-standing relationship of solidarity with Unión del Barrio, and a representative from Unión del Barrio, Ernesto Bustillo, will be speaking at the forthcoming 5th Congress of the African People's Socialist Party in July 10th through the 14th in Washington, D.C. For more information on the 5th Congress, go to asiuhuru.org. The 5th Congress is the first Congress that has happened in quite some time. And it's in a historic, significant event where leadership from around the world will be convening to discuss the developments of the African Socialist International and the African People's Socialist Party and what comes next. So if you are interested in attending, be sure to register on asiuhuru.org, and also be sure to check out Chairman Amala Yeshitela's political report, which is also on asiuhuru.org. Excuse me. Also, if you'd like to call in, the number in the U.S. is 727-565-1599. In the UK, 44020-8133-6629. If you're listening and you want to call in through Skype, the Skype ID is Uhuru Radio. And if you have any questions or comments that you want to send in through email, it's dj@uhururadio.com. So in the speech that we just played, Ron Goches says that the struggle that is taking place here is not a struggle only in Mexico, but a global struggle, an international struggle against capitalism and imperialism. And he also quotes Che Guevara, who really embodies the spirit of internationalism and solidarity. And on that note, we want to draw some connections between the situation taking place in Mexico, in occupied Mexico, and the situation taking place in occupied Azania in South Africa. Right now, the World Cup is taking place in South Africa, in occupied Azania. So, Kelly, you've been looking into the World Cup.
Well, yeah, it's such a significant event publicly. It's being advertised at almost any corporate business. You go to McDonald's, they're advertising the World Cup. You go to bars, you see them giving deals on drinks watch the World Cup, get beers, and you know, anywhere that is owned by a corporation that has their hand in the sports world is putting a lot of money towards this event, while they overlook the conditions in the local area that's ridden with poverty and economic problems being caused by outsiders. The area was cleaned up, per se, before the World Cup started. They gathered locals and put them in internment camps so that people coming from around the world wouldn't have to be bothered by seeing any sort of negative conditions. They just pushed aside the reality of the area and supplanted it with this artificial public event that's supposedly supposed to connect us globally, and yet it's an artificial means through which people try to understand each other. It's a completely plastic, you know, sports event. It's not. It doesn't have any significance on the people who are being burdened by the economy there. And like, for example, there's a company that owns solar technology, and they brought electricity simply for viewing the World Cup game to villages that have never had electricity. And they set up these solar viewing stations so that they could watch the World Cup as it happened. That's all they're going to get. They're not going to get any other attention. They're just going to be able to watch what's keeping them from being part of the rest of the world.
Well, I think, on the idea of solar-powered televisions for people to watch the World Cup, let's be honest, they're not doing that so that people can watch the World Cup. They're doing that so they can publicize that they're doing it and make it a... And what's very, at least it strikes me as very odd and offensive, is when you watch the World Cup, you see this... On the Coca-Cola cans, you see these soccer balls, and join the global celebration. And then if you're watching it, you see these images during commercial breaks and between clips of commentators, you see these videos of smiling African faces in traditional dress dancing around and clapping their hands. And they're advertising as if these people are being represented by the cup, and by the World Cup being in South Africa, and this just isn't true. It's very similar to what happened with the Olympics recently in, I believe it was Toronto. It was Toronto, wasn't it?
Vancouver.
Or Vancouver. And regardless, you had the same thing happen. You had they did essentially a street sweep. Anybody who was homeless or indigent or even living in perhaps a makeshift shanty or something like that. Immediately taken off the streets, and it really gives them an excuse to criminalize the poor, which is done anyway in South Africa. I mean, they've been doing that for a long time. So really, the idea of a major corporate circus coming to town and supposedly bringing new life into providing jobs and what have you is just a myth. Some work may come to the local people, but for the most part, they bring in the labor they already have. They're not going to train any workers in the area. It is a corporate farce.
Yeah, and actually, I don't have a significant amount of information about this, but I do know that right when the World Cup started, some of the workers began to protest, and they immediately basically blacked out any news about that on the media. There was a little bit mentioned that they weren't cooperating and it was becoming a violent situation and the police had to become involved. But, you know, after that, we didn't hear anything about why these protesters were, you know, fighting back. And obviously, it's a result. It shows the true meaning of the World Cup. It's basically like an elite occupation for corporations just to make money.
I think the promotional tagline of "Join the Global Celebration" really does sum it up, as far as how disingenuous and I mean the World Cup is like a metaphor for globalization in general, or what globalization is presented to be, this idea of people, you know, having this big global multicultural party.
It's global celebration for the capitalists.
Right.
And, you know, you also notice that because Africa is commonly used as an image for charity funds, they also had some segments about, you know, U2 or other celebrities doing charity work, while glossing over the fact that most of these charity funds exploit their donations and put, you know, you don't know where the money's going, and these charity funds aren't going to help, you know, they're not going to change what's causing the problems. They're just there to aid them. So it has so many, it's multifaceted in how evil it is.
Another interesting parallel, or revealing parallel, between the situation in Mexico and in occupied Azania is that with the recent SB 1070 bill, under the system of apartheid in South Africa, African workers were forced to show passes to the settler police at any time, even though this was on stolen and occupied African land. This is the same situation that indigenous people are facing in occupied Mexico with SB 1070. And there was also, in 1968, the Olympics took place in occupied Mexico. Mm-hmm. And Matt, if you wanted to speak to that.
Well, in 1968, the Mexican Olympics, the Olympics in Mexico City, it's infamous in very many ways. You had the Olympic, you had one gold medal winning athlete and one silver medal winning athlete, who both raised their fists in support of Black Power, who subsequently were stripped of their medals and banned for life from the Olympic Games, which, mind you, this is in 1968. You also had an Australian person, I believe he was a swimmer, who wore a civil rights badge when he was presented with his medal. He was consequently left out of the following Olympic Games in 1972. Also, preceding the Olympics, there were student protests, which eventually escalated into riots with violence on both sides, to be fair. But I think it's fair to say who the aggressor was. The student protests were predominantly about the fact that labor unions had been pretty much outlawed. Human rights were declining. Democracy, as far as we're concerned, had essentially come to a standstill, a grinding halt. And the students coming out to protest and demand what is rightfully theirs, democracy, freedom, liberty, they were consequently fired upon, and many were killed. And this is... it's historically speaking, the Olympics, the World Cup, large events like this, which attract large corporate sponsors, frequently result with state violence against their own people, or if not violence, then at the very least oppression, because it's all about taking from one and giving to the other. That's on the topic of the papers. I think that's very interesting because, if you look at the way they introduce the necessity, they play. You spoke about the mainstream corporate media and how it framed the debate of the Arizona SB 1070, and you frequently heard that they needed this law to combat the rising drug trade and the violence surrounding that drug trade, which is spilling over the border, as we were told. Well, spilling over the border is, that's just misleading, because a majority of the weapons that these Mexican cartels are armed with, they come from the United States. I mean, we produce the most weapons on, from Glocks to missiles, we're number one as far as that's concerned. And as far as the drug trade is concerned, Where do the majority of drugs, at least coming towards the U.S., where do they come from? Well, the majority of the heroin comes from Afghanistan, and, well, the U.S. is currently occupying Afghanistan. How about that? The majority of cocaine frequently comes from Colombia. And, well, look at that. One of our best friends, President Alvaro Uribe, president of Colombia, who was also a close friend of Pablo Escobar. If you look at his history, when his father was killed by leftist FARC rebels many years ago, he took a helicopter to go immediately see his dying father, and the person who lent him that helicopter was Pablo Escobar. The links between the Medellin cartel and Alvaro Uribe are countless, and the links between him and the paramilitary groups there. But he is most certainly a narco president, and we are currently building upon 7 military bases in Colombia, which are obviously going to be used to quote unquote fight drug trafficking. But really, we're just suppressing freedom fighters in the area, the FARC, the ELN, and obviously it's there to try and keep an eye on Hugo Chavez and Evo Morales, make sure they don't go anywhere. The drug trade, sorry, got off for a second. The drug trade, what comes through the Mexican border? Predominantly methamphetamine and marijuana. So, it's our demand. It's the U.S. demand that has this coming over. But then again, if you look at it, methamphetamine and marijuana, well, those are homegrown drugs. That happens in the United States. And two of which are frequently ignored in light of many of the other more powerful narcotics. So, there are limitless solutions that could solve border violence around the drug trade. And Jan Brewer, who signed the law into effect, the fact of the matter is she wasn't elected as governor. Janet Napolitano was governor of Arizona until she was elected as Surgeon General or Attorney General by President Obama. It's odd that this woman would have the audacity to sign such a bill into power when she, in fact, was not elected. That she does not have that popular support. So it's a little audacious that she would do such a thing. And furthermore, in light of that, we come to realize that 70-something percent of Arizona support this law. Well, that's not such a surprise, considering some recent events going on in Arizona concerning their position on ethnic studies program, and most recently a mural that was going on in Arizona. Jesse, did you want to?
Yes. Well, thank you, Matt. Actually, before we talk about the mural, we have a caller.
Oh, very well.
So.
Uhuru.
Uhuru.
Uhuru, this is Stephanie calling in from St. Pete. I just want to really appreciate you guys bringing this important topic to the show today. It's really, you know, it's just really clear from what you're saying and the different points that you're making that the U.S., through this bill, is just maintaining control over the resources. The stolen land of the U.S., which, like what was said, was stolen by white people, genocide committed against indigenous people to, you know, win and keep this land. And just like in Africa, if indigenous people had control over their own land and resources, they wouldn't need to make that suicidal journey across the border to try and follow the, you know, the trail of resources and come to the U.S. for whatever they, you know, see as some kind of opportunity, quote unquote. So I really appreciate it because it brings it back to the question of the resources. And the other point I just want to say briefly that you made about the solar TV is being brought in to watch the World Cup is so incredibly offensive. If they can solve the question of electricity for 1 month, 1 week, 1 day in Africa by hooking up solar panels, why do African people suffer without electricity every single day? It's absolutely obscene. The control of the resources to give and take away at whim. And I just think it brings us back, you know, especially on this show, we have to deal with that important question of our responsibility as white people. And I just appreciate you guys exposing all of these questions because what it really says to me is we have to take responsibility for this reality. the fact that, not just the fact that these laws are getting passed and we have to vote differently or something like that, but it just, but that, that what it gets down to is African, indigenous, and other oppressed peoples deserve absolutely, we must demand that they have control over their own resources and their own land. And that, in fact, they would, if that were the case, if we look around the world, they would be the richest people on the planet because of all the incredible wealth. Just like, you know, with the whole oil question, too, just to kind of throw another angle out there, there was an article in The Guardian that went through, you know, just the, you know, all of the incredible and devastating oil spills in Nigeria alone committed by Shell oil company that the world, you know, doesn't hear anything about. It happens all the time. Over the last couple decades, all of the oil that has devastated the drinking water, the, you know, the water that people actually use on a day-to-day basis, that the people have no control over, that they benefit nothing from. And the area, the delta there, is absolutely devastated. Yet, you know, this, what they're calling a spill, you know, in the Gulf, where it affects white people, is world news. It, you know, it has to be held accountable. So I just think, you know, for us, in solidarity, what can we take away from these things? I think we have to talk about the fact that we have to take responsibility for it, and what does that mean? We have to stand on the side of the rights of people to resist this oppression and the right for them to have control over their land, their lives, and their resources. And I know that's why I'm part of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. And again, I just really appreciate you three talking about this and exposing this issue. And I know, you know, there's so much more around SB 1070 that, you know, the ripple effects that it's had. They're even talking about making changes to the 14th Amendment. They're attacking the children in schools and what can be taught in the schools. And, you know, I really appreciate the show today. I guess I don't have a question. I just wanted to to participate. And, you know, I really appreciate everything that has been said. Uhuru.
Uhuru. Uhuru. Thank you, Stephanie. Well, I'd just like to touch on what she was saying about what we can do. Really, I mean, the word solidarity means more, it means so much, but there's several ways in which people need to stand up and defend. Don't be shy. Like, that's a big problem. You know, people are taught by the news and cultural thoughts in America to be shy about politics and not, you know, don't talk about those things because it causes problems. We have problems. We need to talk about them. That's the only way they'll be solved, or else they'll keep going.
People like to say, you know, don't talk about politics, you know, don't bring politics into social settings and everything. I mean, politics is just the way a society governs itself. And right now, that control is in the hands of a small group of people who benefit from the exploitation and oppression of the masses. So if you want to talk about, if you want to say, oh, let's not talk about politics, then you're just ignoring, and especially if you're a North American or European, then you're just choosing to look away from the fact that all of your material wealth and social privilege is a result of slavery and colonialism. And so solidarity is based on that understanding, and is based on not just understanding that and saying, oh, I get it, all of my material wealth and social privilege is a result of slavery and colonialism. It's not just an intellectual comprehension. It's about what you do with that information. And if you convert that into action, that's when it becomes solidarity. And Che actually has a quote that is used by the Uhuru movement. Amalia Shitela quotes it frequently, and it's, solidarity is not a matter of well-wishing, but of sharing the same fate, whether in victory or in death. And that really gets to the heart of it. Matt?
I think I've told you this before. I personally love the quote, and I feel that the idea of solidarity, particularly amongst North American activists, has kind of been worn down a bit. It's been watered down to the point where person can claim solidarity without ever having to do anything. I mean, hell, on Facebook, I'm a member of the South Florida Palestine Solidarity Network. What does that mean? It means I get updates. It doesn't really mean anything. Solidarity really needs to be brought back. It needs to be heavy-handed.
Well, people are being diffused now. Well, we have a caller, so we'll talk about that later. But
caller, you're on the air. We lost the call.
Okay. Well, I was just about to talk about the BP oil spill that Stephanie mentioned and how that's such a significant symbol of how capitalism controls our society, because BP is such a significant corporation globally, and how do they get away with basically messing up the ecosystem in the whole Gulf Coast? How do they get away with that and no one lifts a finger at them? You know, just like people just watch the news, listen to the news, and there's no reaction.
Okay. Now, caller? Oh. Yeah.
But yeah, so I was just saying that when the issues threaten our environment, the capitalist environment, it gets attention. But as long as we don't have to deal with those other problems they are in other places that have been dealing with spills for over 20 years, you know, it doesn't matter.
Stephanie mentioned Nigeria, and it's interesting because there have been countless spills in Nigeria that have topped the amount of oil that has leaked out in Nigeria and in places like Ecuador. You have oil spills that are much larger than the one in the Gulf. They don't receive as much press attention because, well, they're not pouring out into the heart of white America. And the interesting thing is right now you have, for instance, the CEO of BP, Tony Hayward. His name is becoming a household name.
Caller, you're on the air.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. This is Scott from Palm Harbor. How are you guys doing?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Well, thank you for this. I really appreciate, as Steffi said, what you guys are talking about. And, and I think that's right. The point of solidarity is not just to get, Facebook updates and sort of say those words. You know, that doesn't mean anything. But, you know, rather taking a real stand, helping to, I think we mentioned through the oil spill, we touched on reparations a little bit. So I think actually helping gather resources for the African International Revolution, I think, is an important step to take. And I'll say something and then pose the question. It's interesting that when we have an oil spill in the Gulf, which we all know is terrible, and we all agree that that's certainly a result of the way capitalism and the way colonialism operates. But that, everyone in America, especially North Americans, white environmentalists and activists are all up in arms about that. But I thought it was interesting that last week, you see the media all up and on, but then last week, $20 billion was put into an account from BP to basically give reparations to all the people that were damaged, by this oil spill. You know, whether it all happens the way they say it's going to is another matter. But I guess my point would be that, look at how much has been taken from African people and indigenous people over centuries. And literally, you can't even discuss reparations without being attacked in those cases, in most venues, certainly the corporate media and the general media. Yet, immediately, people who are affected by the soil spill, many of whom are North Americans and so forth, can get reparations right away. And I just thought that was something that was we needed to note. But any comments on that, guys?
Well, yeah, it's obvious that the main reason they did the whole $20 billion reparations for people who are going to be affected by it was as a political move, business move. I mean, it's smart to at least acknowledge that they did do something wrong. Whether or not they're going to do it effectively is another question. Regardless of how much money they put in to try and fixing the situation, the nature is still messed up, and it doesn't solve future oil problems that we're obviously going to have to deal with. Matt?
Well, Scott, I like that you mentioned, drew the comparison between the reparations that BP may give out and all the other indigenous oppressed people in the world who still are awaiting their deserved reparations. You have Shell, who has countless spills in Nigeria and who refuses to admit to it or pay up for it. You have Union Carbide, who is responsible for now it's Dow Chemical, who's responsible for the Bhopal disaster, and they still won't fess up to it. And you have the same thing that went on in Ecuador with, I believe it was Chevron, and they still won't fess up to it. So here you have an accident of the same caliber, yet because it is going on in North America, yet it's because it's going on to happening to the privileged, they are forced to come up with reparations, as opposed to people that they can just or try and sweep under the rug.
Sure. Thank you, Scott. You've been listening to Solidarity Not Charity on Uhuru Radio, the online voice of the African International Revolution. I am Jesse Neville, and I am here with Kelly Barron and Matthew Diaghi.
Uhuru.
Now I'm going to read some announcements. We have a book club study series, a study of Overturning the Culture of Violence by Penny Hess. It is taking place June 24th at USF Barnes & Noble Cafe. Oh, excuse me. USF Library Media Center on 140 and 7th Avenue South. I really encourage everyone to come to that study. Overturning the Culture of Violence is an extremely powerful book that outlines in great detail the history of violent oppression of indigenous people and African people by imperialism, and also outlines a way forward for North Americans and Europeans in the form of solidarity. Anyway, that's the end of our show, so thank you very much for listening, and make sure that you go to uhurusolidarity.org and join the Uhuru Solidarity Movement.
Uhuru.
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 Get ready now for one of the most important events of our time, the 5th Congress of the African People's Socialist Party. The Congress convenes on July 10th through 14th in Washington, D.C. under the slogan, One People, One Party, One Destiny. Hear presentations by African People's Socialist Party Chairman Omali Eshetela and other leaders of the APSP, and witness as the party ushers in a new era of struggle. A new day is on the horizon. The U.S. front of the African Revolution will never be the same. For more info on the Congress, go to www.apspcongress.org or call 727-821-6620.